Well, hello again. This is Frieda Morrison. Welcome to Scots Radio. In this programme, where we feature and celebrate the Scots language in a' its colours and carry-ons. We'll keep the carry-ons under control. It's nae easy when you have a team like ours. Richie Werner, our soon sorter, and resident folklorist Steve Byrne, they're a' here and we'll hear for them later. In this edition, as the nichts draw in, fan better than to speak about stories and maybe fliggity things and scary stories and even the best is Dracula. Ojibwees. And we hear fu yon manny was maybe created in the northeast of Scotland. I say name here, just listen for Dracula. You can tell that the soon sorter Richie has got totally involved with the sound effects of the soon sorter. And I think that was the second version of the thunder and lightning. I think there's probably a bit more, Steve, to come. And still with stories, we're going through the pages of our new book of stories for The Borders, with author James Spence. And we canna get into that nuke of the country without speaking about rugby. And far better to speak to you about that than rugby commentator Bill Johnson. We're spinning like a peary again. But it gets us out of the hoose, as we I say. And we start wee Dracula. It was like somebody dropping plates. Right, Derek Jennings is a writer and local historian for Lonmainier Peterhead. And he spent a long time researching the notion that the writer Bram Stoker was not only inspired by the northeast coast up round about Cruden Bay, but actually wrote a lot of the story in that area, where are the atmosphere of Slane's Castle as a very appropriate backdrop. Well, I arranged to meet up with Derek to find out more, and he said to me, meet him at the Kilmarnock Arms Hotel in Cruden Bay. But that's what I did. But fit why? Fit why the Kilmarnock Arms in Cruden Bay? Derek?
The story of Bram Stoker in this hotel figured very prominently in the story of and his inspiration for Dracula. He found this place, the whole Cruden Bay, Finny Fall, the whole area, really inspirational. As I say, when he came up to this area, and he came up a lot to this area, he would just stroll up and down the beaches, not really wanting to speak to anybody when he first arrived. He just absorbed the atmosphere. He saw the coast in all its majesty, you might say, and all its the ferociousness of the, you know, how ferocious the sea could be up here in Ar. He just absorbed all this, and he came up for years before really, and the things was starting to build up in his head, and he started to get the ideas generating, and then he started to speak to the local folk. Some of the tales that he heard must have had an impact on him.
Before I go into the impact and far he got his inspiration there, was this far he bade as a tale?
He did. The first time he come up, he stayed in Peterhead. He bade in Peterhead, and he didn't dwell long in Peterhead. He decided he would walk up down the coast, and he walked exactly 8 miles down the coast and landed up at the small port of Cruden Bay and the village itself. Village overshadowed by the hills around about it, red slate roofs and all the rest of it, he was immediately struck. So, for there, he actually, on that very first day that he visited, he decided to book into the Kilmarnock Arms, and he stayed here for a couple of days. And all he did was he just walked up and down the wee bit of beach, went up towards Finny Fall and up towards Ora Rocks towards Slane's.
I mean, he couldn't get a lot of other places more atmospheric than Slane's Castle, could you?
No. I mean, you come here in a night. Okay, it's near the same now because it's near lit up. But in his time, it would have been all lit up. It was occupied by the Earls of Errol.
Folk were still biding
it. Oh, absolutely. The castle was on a go until the 1930s. So it was all lit up and very atmospheric. And I mean, I have come across records at Mary Shelley, if I wrote Frankenstein, also bade at that castle. She and I found out what the link is as well with some friends of her for London, and that's why she was up here visiting the Earls of Errol. So there must be something about this area. So, you've got the author of Frankenstein and Dracula, who came up and lived in this area.
I mean, Ormond has been out in a storm on this coast. Will there be any doubt for the atmosphere comes from? Because he kind of helped but be part of that atmosphere.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And if we come on to Dracula, I mean, the thing is, he's speaking about the inspiration that he got. Well, there is some writings in his book that it states Whitby, but he never really visited Whitby. I can't find any evidence that he went to Whitby. He probably seen postcards, and I think maybe there was a theatre production that was there. But in Whitby, you certainly got the Isle Abbey overlooking, and you've got a harbour big enough to take the ship for the Baltic, which was supposed to have carried Dracula across the sea to Britain. You would never have gotten a ship that size into the wee harbour at Cruden Bay.
So it's a combination between Whitby and here, but mostly here, you think?
As I say, there's no evidence he ever visited Whitby, none at all, but there's plenty of evidence that he was here. He came back here for about 10 years, 10
years
on a trot, just about he come up here. Every time he had to finish a book or to start a book, he would come up here. If his editors were piling on the pressure and stuff like that, he would come back up here and he would research his book further.
Tell me a wee bit about his childhood and father inspiration, because his mother played a big part. And I suppose if it was in his head, if it was rumbling about the thoughts and the inspiration, again going back to Dracula.
Bram Stoker was born in 1848, and Finney was born, he wasn't expected to live. For the first 8 years of his life, he was in his bed for the first 8 years. So his mother used to tell him tales about, just all sorts of things, banshees and things like that, you know, Irish fairy tales and stuff. She went through a period of cholera in Dublin in the 1830s, and she told him all sorts of horrific stories about folk being pulled out of the hospitals while they were still alive and buried in big pits, crawling out of the pits. Now, I mean, for a person under eight, hearing all these stories
terrifying. We mentioned earlier he would have understood what the Doric was. Did he write anything in the Doric?
He wrote in the Doric, yes, he wrote four books in the Doric. I can only remind two offhand, The Waters Moo and The Mystery of the Sea. And The Mystery of the Sea is about a seer, a person who could visualise it. And she was one of the main characters in it. The Waters Moo was about customs officers.
Was he well-liked by the locals? Only sign up.
I think he must have been, because why would he not come back, you know, year after year
if he wasn't
well-liked by the locals? Not only was he quite well-known in Cruden Bay, at one point in time, I can't remember the year, it was about 1905 or something like that, but he was asked to open a Peterhead flower shop. And I mean, he was so well-known in the area. And the reason I asked him to do that was because he had made this area popular before the railway came. So that was one of the reasons that they asked him. And I mean, the railway did come to Cruden Bay eventually, but...
Mm-hmm. So when was Dracula actually published?
It was 1897 that Dracula was actually published. I think he had been absorbing all the information and the stories that he was getting for the local people long before that.
Is there any legends here that he would have picked up on?
Oh, there's quite a few legends here, but one of the main ones I think that probably was his focal inspiration would have been the story that at Lammastide, and if you had the site, you could, if you come here, all the people far had wrecked onto the Scours Rock just off the coast of Cruden, drowned, they would have rose up out of the water in a moonlight night, and they would have formed a procession, and they would have walked to St. Olaf's Well, which is just in the middle of Cruden Bay here. I think the inspiration, he started writing Dracula up here. It does mention in his autobiography that he started it. And I am convinced the amount of times he come here was that this area was a true inspiration for Dracula. You come here at night in a stormy night and you'll see why. No doubt about it.
Jibberies, fleggity flegs. And just to add to the fleggets, you can see a video version of that interview wee Derek at Cruden Bay and shots of Slane's Castle are runabout on our new website, www.scotsradio.com. It's a wild and lonely place. near our website, but Slane's Castle. Now, Richie and Steve, you've both been listening to that. I didn't want to involve Richie much. He's been involved enough as it is. Steve, what do you think? Is it plausible?
It sounds like it's one of the things that's going to rumble on for years between kind of Cruden Bay and Whitby. I mean, we are kind about the Whitby connection, but I thought it was interesting. Can you tell me if it was his connection with Cruden Bay? Why would he keep going back there?
He just liked
there?
The place.
Aye, I'd be off interested to find out how he ended up
there. I mean,
there.
You might find it really just going off on a totally different tangent, but Lawrence O'Araba used to go up there as well on his motorbike. I leave that with you. But it's interesting, the dates there. You got 1905. Now, that's fun. Gavin Gregg was publishing, Greg Duncan, publishing the Greg Duncan collection. 1897, you know, he must have been gone about at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's the same area.
Aye. And, of course, Gavin Gregg was a playwright and nothing as well. So, I mean, writing books in the Doric, I didn't ken that Bram Stoker did that for an Irishman. That's
Bram
great.
Stoker spoke Doric. Aye. I mean, I've told a few folk that and they get fit. No, Bram Stoker was a Doric speaker.
Aye.
Right, I think we need a bit of music now. This is for Gordon Gunn's new CD card, Wick to Wickham. And that was written for a music and poems collaboration with Caithness writer George Gunn. This is Money, Stories, Fame, Stuff. I love that little bit of piano at the end. Garden Gun for his CD Wick to Wickham on the Green Tracks label. And it's a cracker. Well, the Storytelling Centre in Edinburgh is a busy place, but it has been busier than usual with the International Storytelling Festival just finished. And I had the pleasure of joining storyteller James Spence there recently for the launch of his new book, Scottish Borders Folk Tales, rich in stories, both tall and true, ancient and mere recent, dark, funny, fantastical and powerful. Well, far better to tell me more about that than James Spence himself and why he thought it was important to write in Scots.
It's my first language. You know, it's the language he spoke before he went to the school. So it's where we get our sense of worth. And I kind of felt that you're kind of battling against the sort of education you got at the school, which I kind of felt the era that I grew up in, it was like a form of punishment.
I've heard a lot of folks say that. But to you, is it important that you write in it as well?
Aye. I mean, I think particularly when you go to storytelling, you're really looking for your voice, and that's where the fluidity is. I didn't hear it in the standard English that we were supposed to speak. Maybe it's different when you hear, you know, the different English dialects, because obviously they've kind of made it natural to themselves. But the standardisation was a kind of false thing.
See, I was listening to you reading extracts, which I'll ask you to read a wee extract again.
Aye.
In a wee minty. But I was listening to reading extracts, and the characters came mere alive to me when you were making them speak in Scots.
That's right.
And leaving in Scots.
That's right.
Somehow the didn't I get fit it was or how it was? Is mm-hmm. it just a magic that the language is?
Aye.
It's given to storytelling, isn't it?
Aye. Well, comes through the natural rhythms, kind of spoken over the centuries, that fits in with the rhythms of nature and often like that, whereas standardisation, as I say, it was a kind of
a bit sterile.
False. Aye, absolutely. Aye. Absolutely.
There's more colour definitely in it. Could I, again, you've just gone through this launch and you've been reading bits and answering questions that you tell folk to ask. That was a great idea. But could I ask you to read a wee bit, the wee bit about...
Aye, certainly.
Was this Tamlin?
This is Tamlin. Aye, it's the second half of it.
Aye.
Well, just tell us when it stopped, like... Fair Janet looked fair peely-wally on hearing all this, and so Tam spoke again. I have to turn through all their shapes to bring me back. That is my journey, for where I am through all the realms to the earth. If you love me, you'll hold on to me for all you're worth. Will you do that, Janet? Janet began, nodding ever so slowly, and then she said, aye, in a voice so sure that it left Tam in nae doubt that she would succeed. The night was dreich but dry with thick cloud shutting out the moon. Nonetheless, fair Janet stepped her way lightly over to Miles Cross. She settled herself in a broom bush on the Melrose Toon side at Miles Cross and waited. For a while, all she could hear was the notions of the wind wheeking through the trees and bushes. Then, very faintly, as if starting in imagination, she thought she could hear a jingling of some sort. As she listened harder, it gradually took on a rhythm. Then unmistakably, it became the ring of bridles coming from many horses. Although there was an unearthly music to it, she was more than glad to hear it. Just as Tam told her, she let the first troop of horses pass and only let go her breath when the jingling grew to its loudest. Then she waited further as the second troop passed by as well. Then, when the last procession of horses reached her, she watched the black horse go by, and then she witnessed the broon yin follow suit. As the broon tail swished past her, she was on her mettle. As soon as she saw the milk-white steed, she sprang for her hiding place and grabbed at the man with a cocket bonnet. She cleeked a hold of him and pulled him down with all her strength and passion. Nae sooner did she have him on the ground than she had him wrapped tightly in her arms. Then, with a voice like a craw, cut through the air, "Tam is away, Tam is away," and frae behind a broom bush a black horse reared up as the Queen of Elfland brought the horse to a halt. Her face shone with an unearthly light, and her sharp, black, bony eyes fell upon fair Janet as she held Tam tightly to herself. The Elfin Queen poured her skinnersome spells down on the prone Tam.
Powerful stuff.
It is.
Again, James, are you aware that you've come to this long tradition of storytellers for the Borders? Are you aware of your heritage?
Besides my father, I never kent any storytellers there.
That's the next question I was going to ask. How did you start? I mean, was it in your family?
Aye. My father, he used to tell stories at the meal table. He used to act the goat, as we used to say. But I used to love his stories, absolutely loved his stories. He used to tell stories about the characters of the toon, basically. Mm. You know the sort of stuff you'll find in...
Was he a professional storyteller?
No. It was just, they made their own entertainment in them days.
There's a lot of stories in the new book. You would say that, there's stories being told over and over again, but this is the James Spence stories.
Aye.
Fits your brand in there, fits your stamp.
Well, there is... probably the style of telling. I mean, besides that, there is yin story that I concocted from a fragment. It's set at the Beaumont Water. Now, the Beaumont Water is the middle of nowhere. It's near Yetham. But we used to use it as our seaside. We used to go there fishing for baggies and that sort of thing. And so the idea of having a story in the middle of nowhere is just brilliant.
Okay. You see, you've got that storytelling kind of... atmosphere already beginning to...
As Stanley Robertson said, he says, "James, you've got that strangeness about you."
I didn't know what to say that. I've never tried to... You've got that strangeness, James.
But it is that. It's kind of a sort of sense of wonder and the eeriness and all.
Aye. It was there just that minute. I could see it. How am I going to pit this? He's got that strangeness. James, been a pleasure speaking to you.
And thanks very much. Thanks very much. Aye.
James Spence, and I love that line, "Her face shone with an unearthly light." And his new book, The Scottish Border Folk Tales, published by The History Press, is priced £9.99, and it's well worth that. And as I said, it's called The Scottish Border Folk Tales, published by The History Press, priced £9.99. Now, Steve Byrne, in relation to my comment about the fact that Lawrence of Arabia used to come up on his motorbike for his holidays to the northeast, talking about Ellen, didn't quite believe me. He said, "Does he not come up on his camel?" Right? So you think there's phones up a hotel. He said, "Can I book a room and I can hear some wife on my camel as well?"
Well, I mean, you've got to do all these things to get the tourists up to Farrier.
You just didn't believe me. He did. Lawrence of Arabia came up on his motorbike for holidays to the northeast. I move on swiftly. Another bit of music. This is for somebody familiar with the Borders. This is Archie Fisher for his new CD, A Silent Song, a song written by himself and appropriate to this time of the year, called Waltz into Winter.
I've only just noticed that the martins have flown and their music has gone from the wire. There's still a good hour for the sun to go down, but already I'm lighting the fire. And we welcome the springtime, the martins and I. Now October will find me alone. There's a pain in a parting without a goodbye. I've just noticed the martins have flown. Hear the high lonesome call as the wild geese pass o'er, like a freight train way up in the blue. as the arrows of autumn to a far southern shore are flying so straight and so true. And we're both birds of passage, the grey lag and I, for the journey is all we have known. But the long winding road and the vast empty sky will be there when the wild geese have flown. And a starburst of chaffinches rise from the winds, and they scatter like leaves on the air. When the summer days end and the autumn begins, is a secret the trees never share. We'll lean to the leeward, the tall pines and I, when the northerlies cut to the bone, and the birch and the willow ash heave a sigh when the last summer breezes have blown. As the dance of the seasons goes around and around, there's a time for all nature to rest. When the green summer pastures have faded to brown and the forest with color is blue, we'll waltz into winter, the autumn and I, in a flurry of russet and gold. And we'll swirl with the snowflakes falling down from the sky while we watch her white blanket unfold. We'll waltz into winter, my sweetheart and I, in the warmth of the love we have known. And give thanks for another good year that's rolled by, while the closer together we've grown.
Archie Fisher, Waltz into Winter, for his new CD, A Silent Song. And that's on the Green Tracks label. Fit, as you can hear, I'm featuring a few this edition, the new Green Tracks new releases this month. And thanks to Ian Green for the support. Really appreciate that, Ian. Now, back to Lawrence Arabia. I have actually got a photo of Lawrence Arabia on his motorbike with a leather lugget bonnet on, somewhere in my collection.
Well, you'll hear put that up on the website then.
Now you've done it. Now I've got to find Lawrence Arabia. Now folks will say, what's Lawrence Arabia on the Scots Radio website? You know, really, they're a really funny bunch of folk doing here. Right, back into the Borders theme and linking into James Spence's new book on Borders Tales. Our resident rumbler and folklorist Steve Byrne has been rumbling about in some of the Border traditions as well. Steve, what have you found?
Well, I've been hearing a look through Walter Elliott's New Minstrelsy of the Scottish Border that he published in 2006, and it's full of all sorts of different things today, with kind of more recent life in the Borders and ways of daying. But the first thing I suppose to speak about is the Border Scots, Borders language down there. So he's written a few paragraphs in the start of the book about that, making a bit of a case for Border Scots. It's a kittle ploy to write Doon Border Scots, mostly because there's nae way that a standard of spelling could be devised. It would be gae near impossible today, as the Souters of Selkirk, the Tearys of Hoyk, and the Gidfolk of Copshaholm a' hae different ways of speaking. It isna easy to pit out Doon on paper when you get so many variations of the spoken word. His friend Ian Landles, the ultimate Hoyk man, as the official arbiter of Tearydom, which I love, is a great phrase.
Aye,
my grandfather was a Teary, so I'll hear that. He would say that he was gone heim for my tie, while Walter would say he was just about to gone heim for my tea. So just a wee
just
inflection.
A wee,
so just an example, but you could get a lot more. But they were just brought up about 12 mile apart, so distance, isn't it? I was the arbiter.
No,
of the
dialect. you were telling me about the different Hairston. We're going to be finishing off with the theme of Hairst, because this is the time of year for Hairston. But we found out there's kind of different Borders ideas about Hairston as well.
Aye, well, the book's full of poetry and bits and pieces of songs as well. And this scene's about Neeps, And it was about using a hoe to thin out the neeps every 6 inches or so, tack the others out and get rid of the weeds for doing the drill. And that was the task of the turnip singlers. So this is a poem for Ronald Kerr of Peebles, the 1930s. So I'll read a wee bit of that. Singling turnips in the sun, singling to the end of day, when the howe weighs near a ton, hashing on and daying away. Up and doing the drills they gae, Jock and Tam together, knocking out the neeps a day, henna time to blether. Ach, that sun shines on their necks, blaring doon at Gineer blinds, pushing sair their house and wrecks, thousand weeds a' different kinds. Aye, this grund is stainy rough, ringing house, see dingle clang. Jock and Tam are just as tough, back and forth they both gang.
No, no, see, you wouldn't believe this either, will you? The neep, the turnip, right, the Swede, was actually introduced to Scotland in the northeast.
Jingle.
At Monymusk, Archibald Grant. He introduced the neep around about the 1720s.
So they had neeps before then?
No. You see, right, back into the Borders theme. They were fashion conscious in the Borders as well, weren't they?
Aye, well, this is today, well, of course, the textile industry in the Borders has had a bit of a checkered history, half a busy at a time, but not so much these days. And, of course, the recession in the 1960s, there was new designs and new kinds of garments that were made to cater to other needs and to diversify, as we're often hearing the folk here today, to keep going in business. And that resulted in this poem by David Johnson. It was based in Kelso and Hoyke in 1974. The Coming Age of Y-Fronts. Oh, are the garments ever made to hide what canna be displayed and keep the booming hosiery trade free o' the strunts? And my old hunkers, undismayed, gie me Y-fronts.
That is sheer poetry.
And there's another 12 verses in it.
We'll just finish with that bit there. Right? Thank you, Steve. Now, as I mentioned earlier, that we're featuring new releases for Green Tracks Records this month. And Steve, you've been listening to another new release for that year. It's a tribute in music and song to John Bellany. Tell us a bit more about John and fit your chosen track.
Well, John was from East Lothian, and you'll ken, some folk will ken that Green Tracks is based in Kirkenzie, near a million miles away from where I bide in Trinet. But John was born in Port Seton, which is just the next toon along for Kirkenzie. They're actually often lumped together when you're reading about them. And he died a couple of years ago, but he was a world famous artist. I mean, he had his paintings in the Tate and the New York Met Gallery and everything, but was very keen on his local area, local traditions, and painted a lot of the fishing scenes and all that kind of thing. So his family put together this CD with Green Tracks, tribute in music and song to John Bellany, and there's getting on for, I think, about 20 tracks on it.
A lovely CD it is,
and
as well.
Half a diverse, great tunes and songs, and we're going to play on here with the McCalmans singing a local landmark, of course, in East Lothian, Aberlady Bay.
Here it is.
The blue port lies before us, lads. The wind blows fair and free. The boat glides o'er the crested wave as if she would be. Or sign the link so Cullen so ain't shining in.
The McAlmonds, We Abba Lady Bay, for a new CD, a tribute in music and song to John Bellany, and that's on the Green Tracks label. Now, we were speaking earlier about some of the traditions and stories for the Borders. Well, we can again do into that nuke of the country without mentioning another tradition, rugby. And it's appropriate at this time in our rugby history to mention rugby. And of course, we've just been through the Rugby World Cup, and sadly Scotland went out in a fairly controversial schmozzle, enough said. Well, the commentator in that match was Bill Johnson. And Colin White met up with Bill near his home in Jedburgh, Riverside Park, the grun of his beloved Jed Forest Rugby Football Club.
It's a lovely wee place, Riverside Park. And you know, I've seen so many games of rugby here over the years with, as I call them, the mighty Jed playing here and sometimes being beaten and other times putting their opponents to the sword and so on. And then, of course, when I was teaching, we used to be down here on Saturday mornings with the school kids.
How did you get started in rugby commentary, Bill?
I've been at it for about 30 years now with this rugby commentary, and it started when the BBC opened the wee substation down at Selkirk, BBC Radio Tweed, as you and I well know, which was, if Radio Tweed did one thing really well, it was that it gave a lot of people from this locality in the South Borders the opportunity to broadcast and to try things. And of course, there are broadcasters, yourself for one, who have gone on and made a career of it. Now, I was teaching as a profession, but I was able to get in and do a rugby preview on a Friday after school had finished, and mass of nerves, I have to remember. I could hardly get my tongue moving because my mouth was so dry. But there we are. Over the years, you gain experience.
A big inspiration for you must have been your uncle, who was a relatively well-known commentator, wasn't he?
Oh, Bill was world famous.
Bill McLaren.
Bill McLaren, yes, he was indeed. I'd never realised Bill was famous until we were covering the first Rugby World Cup back in 1987 in New Zealand. And Bill was covering for BBC Television, who had the contract at the time, and I was covering for Radio Scotland. And I just followed along in his slipstream, to be quite honest. But it was when we got to New Zealand, and he was just, that the New Zealand rugby public looked upon this man from Hoik with awe and respect and reverence. And he was just loved. Huge, huge influential figure in world rugby. And that's the first time I realised he was famous. But of course, he was great for his wee phrases as well, you know, Doddy Weir, like a mad giraffe, you know, and Peter Dodds taking a conversion at the posts, a wee twitter, then plonk. Yeah. And the thing was, he broke the mould, because commentary of sport up until round about the time Bill started had been quite correct and plummy. And when he started to come in with these phrases, Simon Gagan, with his arms whirling like an octopus, and folk began to get the imagery and they began to sort of see this person and compare him to the animal that Bill had compared him to. And it just threw a new light on the personalities who were playing the game, and he brought so much to rugby.
And he never tried to pretend he was anything other than he was, that he spoke anything other than he was. Yeah. He was very much a Borders lad. Do you try to use Borders phrases, just Scots, in your commentaries?
I don't try to, but I find myself using one or two words. They just seem to slip out. Others I have to bite my tongue and not use at times when Scotland are in the doldrums. But, you know, I've heard myself say at Murrayfield, for example, when we've been setting the scene for an international, that there's a sort of smear of rain or a drow, which I believe I heard my grandfather McLaren use this word, drow. And I think it's to do with a very fine misty rain as well. But he always used it in connection with Liddesdale, away down in Newcastleton, towards the west of the Borders. And I've always said that, I used to say at Murrayfield, there's a bit of a smear falling here in Murrayfield, and down in Liddesdale they'd call that a drow, and blah, blah, and on it would go, and on it would go. But, and I've described players as gangly and lanky, but to be honest, I don't really search for words in a Scots language. I've often wanted to do one in the Hoig dialect, you know. You can if you were going to come out of scrum like that with your head sticking up. I wonder what on earth's going to happen next, and all the spectators would be shouting their heads off, you know. And I kind of wondered whether a Hoyk dialect rugby commentary. Well, there might be 13,000 listeners up the road in Hoyk. You never know.
You've plenty of time to try it yet, Bill. It has to be said, though, finally, it's a Gaidhrich time to be a Scottish rugby commentator and supporter, isn't it?
But no, the Scottish rugby public are a long-suffering public. Wee Roy Laidlaw always says to me, it's never easy being a Scottish rugby supporter. And it isn't, actually, because you've got to be in for the long haul. Ach, you never know. We live in hope.
Kelly Brown with that scrum cap of his on and the beard looking a bit like Black Jake the Pirate. The French line out falling apart. Hamilton gets it out to Lawson. Lawson to Weir. Miss pass to Dunbar. Evans is there. Dunbar tries to take it on himself. Evans wanted a wee scamper down that left touchline. Here goes Hogg. Bang.
Bill Johnson speaking to Colin White. And a big thank you to Phil Goodlad for BBC Scotland for the rugby audio clips. Really appreciate that, Phil. Bit of music again before we say our cheery byes. This is for that tribute to John Bell in the CD for Green Tracks Records. And this is Phil Cunningham and Ali Bain playing Bonaparte's Retreat, fitting for the anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar. Big number of Scots on board the British ships fighting in that battle. Bonaparte's Retreat, for Phil Cunningham and Ali Bain, for the John Bellany tribute CD on Green Tracks. Right, we're just about there, and before we go, Steve, what's going on?
A few things going on in November. We've got the Perthshire Amber Festival. Of course, that's a Dougie MacLean festival happening up in around Dunkeld. And that's 10 days of music with folk like the Wrigley Sisters, Bella Hardy, Emily Smith, Aurora, we've played in the show a couple of times, Corinne Polwart, Blazing Fiddles and Sin Sheen, and amongst many others. Button, Boxes and Moothies is what they call a free read convention, the 6th to the 8th of November in the Elphinstone Institute, University of Aberdeen. So it's ahings today with moothies, concertinas, melodeons, jews harps, ahing you can think that has a free read in it. The Kerry and Stream Festival in Edinburgh is celebrating for the 15th time new Hamish Henderson's Life and Legacy, with a whole host of acts, the Paddy Callaghan Trio, a celebration of the man who never died, Joe Hill, and the annual lecture at the Lothian Chambers in the city centre, Tony McManus, Margaret Bennett and the group Bar Lua. We've played them a couple of times as well. And the annual celebration of the Scots Fiddle takes place in the Queen's Hall and Summer Hall in Edinburgh for the Scots Fiddle Festival on the 20th to the 22nd of November.
Thank you very much. Now, as a special and fitting ending to the programme at this time of harvest or hairsting, I want to let you hear Enigma prize recordings for a sermon I filmed in 1993 featuring Enigma heroes or heroines, the Reverend Dr. Joyce Colley, doing a sermon about the hairst, delivered in St Andrew's Kirk in Inverurie. The Reverend Dr. Joyce Colley, who died in 2011, was a legend, had a huge knowledge of the Scots language, played a key role in 1954 in the work of the Scottish National Dictionary Project, centred at the School of Scottish Studies in Edinburgh, based her first degree thesis on life and language of the North East, remembered at the School of Scottish Studies for studying Hebrew during her lunchtimes. Latterly, she was the much-loved minister in Strathdon, West Aberdeenshire. And among her many translations, in 1995 she collaborated in a trilingual poetry book, Songs in Three Tongues, with Rory MacDonald providing the Gaelic, and English translation, the Reverend Colley and Derek McClure, doing the Scots. Thank you to the Reverend John Mack for providing this information, and a lot more forby. And I wouldn't forget being there that morning in St Andrew's Kirk in Inverurie with the congregation, packed to the gunnels, IH groups, and I mind the big farmers in their long black coats and best bonnets, and a lot of folk with tears coming down their cheeks. After Joyce had shaken hands with the congregation going out the door, she turned to me and said, "What did I say to Mark the Mar, great Frieda?" I replied, "I didn't ken Joyce, but he did it to me enough." Well, I'll leave you with the voice of the Reverend Dr. Joyce Colley and an extract fae that Hearst's sermon. And you can see that entire sermon and the film of that sermon on our new website, www.scotsradio.com. And the music track is fae the CD, Legacy of the Scottish Fiddle, with Alistair Fraser on fiddle and Paul Mochlis on piano. The track is appropriate for Joyce and her love of the North East. It's called The Beauty of the North. So, for me, Frieda Morrison, or soon starter Richie Werner, and resident folklorist Steve Byrne, bye the new, join us again, and here a look at our Scots Radio website. This is the Hearst, and the Reverend Dr. Joyce Colley.
And then Jesus speaking about Hearst. The farmer comes and he shoves his seed. And then he gets on with the business of working. He gings and does other things, and he rises in the morning and he beds at night. And the seed grows without him paying any muckle heed to it. It begins to move, and the seed bursts open, and the wee green pops up abeen the ground. And it grows, till the ear's a corner there, and the hairst time comes. The poor of God is working there and eth the ground in the seed. And hairst is God's gift. We've been a grand hairst this year and grand weather together then. But we all have hairsts in our own lives too. Families that grow, and we have been spending our days feeding them and providing for them and thinking little about exactly what we're doing. But they're growing. And they grow, and the another generation comes, and we find ourselves proudly paired to a family. And so, let's mind that God's in our personal hearse. The hearse that come for our day by day darg. The ordinary jobbies that have to be done, and all the things that we think of at the time is half a dreich and dreary. But God's in them, and the aim is our hearse and our treasure. In the wee minutes in the day that we spend lifting up our hearts to Him. And the whiles that we spend giving hurt to other folk. And the times that we forget ourselves and minding others. There are the coins that mark up our treasure. The day we'll be glad that nae moth nor dust can corrupt. And we carry it home.